Welcome to the Mushroom's Apprentice. My guest today is the esteemed mage and celestial priest, Christopher Warnock, who will be discussing astrological talismans. And before I introduce him, I want to begin with a quote by Paracelsus from Claude Lécouteux's text, The Book of Grimoires. Quote, "They too, the signs, characters, and letters, have their strength and efficacy. If the nature and distinctive essence of metals, the influence and power of heaven and the planets, the meaning and arrangement of the characters, signs, and letters harmonize and simultaneously correspond with the observation of the days, time, and hours, what then, in heaven's name, could prevent a sign or seal manufactured this way from possessing its force and ability to work?" End quote. Well, Christopher Warnock has been a traditional astrologer and Renaissance astrological magician since 1998. He has been called the father of the traditional astrological magic revival and the elder statesman of astrological magic. With John Michael Greer, Mr. Warnock translated the Latin Picatrix, the most important grimoire of traditional astrological magic, and has written and published many books on astrological magic and traditional astrology. Mr. Warnock also teaches astrology and magic courses and offers authentic astrological talismans. He follows the spiritual path of Hermeticism, a practical path to Gnosis, based on the writings traditionally attributed to Hermes Trismegistus, as well as working with the Renaissance ceremonial magic of Cornelius Agrippa, Marsilio Ficino, and Picatrix. He is working towards using astrological magic theurgically as a practice that leads to spiritual Gnosis as a celestial priest. He is the steward of the Society of Astrologers, the International Association of Traditional Astrologers. His website is renaissanceastrology.com. Welcome, Christopher.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
I am so happy to have you. This is a great honor. So what I'd like to do first, because I'm always so fascinated by the backstory, is just hear about what led you to this path that you're on.
You know, it's funny because, I was just thinking about this. So when I was a kid, I had two things. I wanted to speak up for the oppressed, like Clarence Darrow, and I wanted to be a wizard. So I knew from a very early age, you know, kind of what the broad outlines of what I wanted to do. I think that, you know, as I was in my kind of like in high school, I just was all caught up with whatever the conventional stuff. And then I went to college first in the United States. And then I started with a junior year abroad at the University of St. Andrews. And then I ended up staying there and graduating. And I actually specialized in Renaissance history. And then I went to law school at the University of Michigan. And they kind of tracked you to either be in a big law firm in Washington, D.C. or New York. So I just kind of followed the flow and ended up in Washington, D.C. And sort of spontaneously in Washington, D.C., I started to become a spiritual seeker. And so a spiritual seeker is kind of, we have this incredible sort of smorgasbord of possibilities that we can follow. And so I started sampling all sorts of different things. And one of the first things I started with was Sufism. There was a Iranian Sufi order in Washington, D.C. that had a meeting place, and I started attending that. So that was probably my first, you know, really sort of deep dive, and I was initiated as a Sufi. And that was kind of the first step on the spiritual path. Now, at the same time, I started just looking at a lot of different stuff, and I had noticed astrology books in the bookstore or whatever, and sort of looked at sort of modern astrology. And it was interesting, but it just didn't seem to have quite the depth that I was interested in. And I just, for some reason, instinctively didn't get to, I mean, I read a couple books, but never did much with it. Then I stumbled on to, there's various names for it, but basically what now I call medieval Renaissance astrology, which is European astrology of the Middle Ages and Renaissance, and then Hoary astrology. And Hoary astrology is, instead of looking at someone's birth chart, you look at the chart of a question. So if you have a significant and important question, you ask an astrologer, and then they note down the time that they received the question and then look at that chart. And then, so that's what I started studying. It's basically by correspondence. Lee Lehman was my teacher. And so then sort of the sister of Hori astrology is what's called electional astrology. And electional astrology is choosing times to take action. So you want to find an astrologically auspicious time to say get married or start a business or something like that. So a chart that would give you a yes answer to a Horary, someone said, should I get married? And you got a yes, that same chart would also be a good chart, an electional chart. It had positive factors. If it was a no, it would be have too many negative factors to be a good chart. So like I said, they're kind of a mirror of each other. So I started getting interested in electional astrology, and then astrological magic was sort of the next step, because in order to make a talisman, an astrological talisman, you have to do it at an astrologically appropriate time. So that's, one of the key factors. So this was, 1990, 1989, something like that. And at that point, the people that were doing the, what we call tradition, again, it's very confusing because we used to, there was various names like traditional astrology, which was pretty much used for the Horary astrology. And then other people came in and said, oh, we have to, the Hellenistic astrology is traditional. So, and then it kind of, there was a big shouting match and everything. And that's been kind of hijacked as a name. So it's a little, the nomenclature is a little confusing. But the medieval Renaissance stuff, nobody who, there were people who were doing Horary and natal astrology. Robert Zoller was, the one who's doing the medieval natal astrology using Guido Bonatti. And then there was Horary astrology using Llewellyn Lilly, who was a 17th century English astrologer. But nobody wanted to do astrological magic because the magic was a little kind of too out there. And so I thought, well, I just want to go. I just was really taken with it and started actually looking at the sources. And there's a good number of traditional sources on astrological magic. Cornelius Agrippa, that you mentioned, three books of occult philosophy. Marsilio Ficino's three books on life. And really the premier sources was Picatrix, which was written in about 1000 AD in Arabic and then translated into Latin in 1256 at the court of Alfonso the Wise of Castile. And so that Picatrix really became the sort of Bible of astrological magic for making talismans. But what I did was to take a look at those sources. And then they don't give complete information, at least from our modern standpoint. They kind of, they're either too advanced or they're leaving pieces out or you already know how to do it. So since I've been trained in traditional astrology, I could take a look at that and kind of fill in the blanks. So basically what I did was two things early on, which is to try to get Picatrix translated, which I did with John Greer. But basically, then the deeper thing is to set up a framework. So to understand how to take those traditional sources and how to work with them. Because one of the problems that people have now is they'll either kind of make it up as they go along, which is what I might call the new age approach without being too pejorative about it, just kind of make it up and throw it together without too much knowledge of the underlying, essence or principles. Or I guess the I have to think of another term other than source. I call it a source fascist, maybe a source, I don't know what to say, obsessive compulsive. But anyhow, what they'll do is they'll look at the source, and if it says you do X, Y, and Z, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And if you ask them why, they say because it's in the book. So they're, it's absolutely inflexible. So for example, if the talisman, they say, make this talisman in a white crystal, then you have to make it in a white crystal. And you couldn't make it in a blue crystal, and you couldn't make it out of bronze, and you couldn't make it out of paper. You have to make it in a white crystal and say, why? Because the book says so. So it's a very circular sort of approach. So what I try to do is to look at it and see the essence of it and to try to understand. Now, this is very much like what I do as an attorney. Because again, as an attorney, I once had a friend of mine say, well, it's easy to be an attorney, just look up the rule in a book. And it's like, it's not, because so many of the situations do not fit the rules. And so what do you do in a situation? I mean, judges spend most of their time trying to figure out a situation that's new, or trying to figure out a situation that doesn't fit exactly in the rules, or deciding that the rules perhaps need to be changed. I mean, it's much more complex. So that's really what you need to do, is to look at the essence of what the purpose of it is, and to see, to understand how that. So that's sort of the things, in that bio, they're talking about the father of being the father of the astrological magic revival. What I did first was to say, let's actually make talismans, which no one was doing. And then what I did was to help translate Picatrix, which is the main source. But the most important thing is to provide a framework for looking at how to look at those sources and how to use those sources in a practical way. Because a lot of what happens on social media is people will come in and they'll say, oh, these are the 50 things you have to do. and they'll just be armchair and say, well, you don't have those 50 things in the election. Well, if you insist on having 50 factors, you can never make it. On the other hand, if you just do nothing or you have one factor, then it's very weak. So you have to have a compromise between practicality and trying to fulfill all the potentially possible astrological factors that you might be able to do. So that's part of it too. And there's lots of different ways of doing it. I mean, that's what other thing I would say finally is that my method is simply my method, you know, and there's many different ways of doing it. So there's not a right way or a wrong way. What you want to do is to understand what your own perspective is and what your own influences are, and then not reject everybody else's stuff merely because it's just different than your own.
And by astrological factors, could you explain what that means? Obviously, when you're doing an election, you're birthing the talisman, essentially, right? At the proper time for the purpose of that talisman, yes?
Yes. I mean, astrology, you know, again, is a methodology, really what I would say orientation. So orienting yourself to these various heavenly cycles. And again, this gets into some other issues too, because how does it work? I mean, this is one thing that people don't, I mean, sometimes people ask that. I mean, I think it's almost considered sort of a naive question. I think if you talk to the average astrologer or esotericist, it's not something they want to really grapple with. And so the typical causality is going to be, I mean, I'm going to say a little bit about worldview. It's extremely important to understand what your worldview is. And a worldview is not just our conscious philosophy, but it's our unconscious assumptions about how things work and what basically it's your reality. And so the tendency is to see reality as, well, obviously it's objectively true. There's only one reality. If you disagree with reality, then you're insane, and not recognize that it's possible to have different worldviews. And so worldview is really not a matter of choice. It's something that really basically is presented to us by our society and by the time that we're in. And so really you could say that we are a manifestation of worldview, that each of us in the modern era is a manifestation of the modern worldview. The other thing I would say about worldview is that it's a lot like gravitation. And so the modern worldview is like a planet or a black hole. It casts a gravitational pull over everybody, every modern person, which is not to say that there's not other influences. So basically the modern worldview is that nothing exists except matter and energy. And so when you say spiritual, then that's psychological. When you say psychological, that means it's a brain function. And the brain is a physical thing. It has electrochemical impulses in it. And then you can break that down to atoms and molecules, which you can break down to subatomic particles. So everything that takes place is the result of the interaction of these subatomic particles according to physical laws or to chance. And that is the ultimate nature of reality. And that's pretty much it is the underlying base that everyone's working from. So there's a lot of people, and again, I hate to say New Age again, but they're doing magic and astrology, which are, quote, spiritual, but their underlying view of reality or their unconscious view of reality is matter and energy. So typically, if you're going to look at astrology and magic and how it works, the normal response as far as how it works is beams or rays, some sort of energy. And there are a lot of people out there that think it's magnetism, that think it's scientific energy, which it's not. There's no detectable scientific energy it's not gravitation, it's not sunspots or string theory, anything like that. But so what people will say is that a little more sophisticated will say, well, it's a spiritual energy, it's akin to physical energy, it's just not detectable. But it's an impersonal force or forces, it's beams, it's rays, that's how it works. So a natal chart is basically conceptualized as sort of like the planets are at certain angles and they're beaming things at you. And so if it's a good beam, it causes good things. If it's a bad beam, it causes bad things. And that's basically the view of how the underlying causality of what's going on, which is, you know, in the traditional view, there is some support for that in terms of rays, but the rays are not a modern electromagnetic ray. They're basically analogized from light. And they saw light as having a level of consciousness, having a level of life and awareness. So it's really a different view. But that was one view of the causality of it. But the spiritual is very hard for us to grasp because we're coming from a society that has no, that's instead entirely energy or mechanical. So to actually grasp what spiritual is, I mean, it often just means good. I'm spiritual, so I'm good, without any further idea of it. Or it's, like I said, it's beams or rays. So that's something that's difficult to grasp. One way to think about it is the underlying relationships, or like that underpin reality. So for example, if you thought about a savanna in Africa, it has a certain biological carrying capacity. I mean, even before there's any life there at all, it has a certain amount of sunlight, a certain amount of water, a certain amount of nutrients. So it has the capacity to have, say, a million tons of biomass. And so of that million tons of the biomass, it could have, like I said, 90 million tons of, of plants. And then it only has the capacity for a million tons of herbivore, and then 100,000 tons of carnivore. And so these interrelationships, and you can't put any more on there. If you tried to have more carnivores, then they would die because there wouldn't be enough for them to eat. So before there's even any life there, all this intricate web of potentialities is already present. And so, and that continually with the life. And so an interesting example of that in terms of the life is that if you think about you have different ecological niches, and those niches, again, pre-exist the existence of any life in them at all. They're already there and pre-existing. So for example, the wolf, right? This is sort of a, 50 to 100-pound carnivore, and it's oftentimes the apex carnivore in the environment it's in, and it can eat various types of rodents and things like that. In say Africa or in America, in Eurasia, that niche is filled by wolves. In Australia, they have marsupial mammals, so they had a wolf like Tasmanian wolf, but it's a marsupial. It looks like a wolf. Its appearance is like a wolf. It fits the same niche, but it is not at all related to it. It has evolved to fit that same niche. But what's a niche? Where's the physical existence of the niche? It's not. It's spiritual. It's a relationship. It's an interpenetrated web of relationships. So that's just one. That's not to say that spiritual is that, but that's just to kind of give a pointer in terms of understanding how the spiritual underlies the material, and the spiritual patterns the material, and the material exists dependent on the spiritual. Without, like I said, another one would be, if you think about sexual reproduction, the one cell creatures, they just split and they make clone, they make exact duplicates of themselves. But at some point, they're evolved the capability to move some of this genetic material over to another cell. And then you have a much more mixing of, instead of having exact duplicates, you have an opportunity to have all sorts of mixing of the genes. It's much more evolutionary, lots more possibilities. But right there, you have sexual reproduction. You have fathers and sons. You have mothers and daughters. And so I can see a father and I can see a son, but I can't see fatherhood. But that inherent relationship is always present whenever you have sexual reproduction. So that's another way to think of the Platonic ideas, not as being some ghostly thing in another physical place, but being the underlying inherent patterning that of reality. And you can glimpse it whether that physically exists or not,
It sounds like an underlying master intelligence. I mean, that's obviously a master intelligence that then.
Well, again, this is what I would say is that certainly in the methodology and the philosophy and the worldview that I'm operating in, which is heavily Buddhist, that consciousness is an inherent quality of the ground of being. And therefore, yes, I would say that intelligence, see the how it expresses itself though, depends on the situation and the matter. I mean, the intelligence of a rock is a rock intelligence. Whereas the intelligence of a bee is a bee intelligence. I mean, it's expressing itself through those manifestations at that point. But yes, I mean, I remember reading this book about, it's talking about, this is by a scientist, it's talking about the evolution of pines. And pine trees evolved before the angiosperms, the flowering plants. And the flowering plants had a lot of advantages in an evolutionary way. So they kind of outcompeted them. So he's saying, well, the pine trees decided they would go up on the mountains and go into areas with lots of forest fires, and they adapted themselves to that. And so I'm really thinking of it as a collective. I mean, there's an intelligence operating at the level of pine tree, as an entity. And now if you challenge the scientists on that, they would say, oh no, that's not true. It's just random evolution. But it is a useful model for conceptualizing how you think about things. But again, in the Buddhist view, we don't exist as individuals anyway. So, you know, but you can certainly react to somebody as a person as a useful model. So that's what I would say about my general approach within the magical and astrological view is much more in terms of personalities. So if I'm interacting with Mars, it's as a personality, as a person, as a basically as an angel. So that's but to say that that's underlying, that's reality. It's a model. It's useful as far as it works. But then everything we do is modeling. So, you know, but yes, I mean, my sense of it is that there is an intelligence. But look at COVID. I mean, that's another. There seemed to be an intelligence operating with COVID. I mean, it was quickly every time they came up with a new vaccine, it was quickly coming up with a way around the new vaccine. It was mutating like crazy. It seemed like it was very intelligent. You know, all the cell, even if it's separate, you know, but the cells in our body, they collectively are operating together. I mean, is there a difference between COVID that's spatially separated and our human body with cells that are connected? I mean, again, these are all sort of levels of you know, there's similarity and difference. So a lot of it is that if you open up your thinking to these possibilities, then you start seeing these patternings. And so insofar as you can practically make use of it, you know, that's the test. You know, if you say, I see this out there, and can I actually make use of it, you know, or a cause a reaction or something like that, then that's what I think that's probably the test. So as you can see, there's a lot to this in terms of before you get to the talismans, because like if you don't know how they work, then you know, or if you have a particular idea, like for example, if you think of a talisman as razor energy is the cause, then you think of the talisman as a battery. So it's this, and the magic comes from the talisman. So when people talk to me, they're often saying, well, do I have to, there's this thing out there that you have to wear 24 hours a day and you have to wear next to your skin. And I'm not sure that part of it's just that everyone knows that. It's only one of those internet things that everybody knows that just gets endlessly duplicated. But I think the logic behind it is it's got energy and you charge it up like a battery and it's radiating energy. So you obviously wouldn't want to have it with you because otherwise you wouldn't have the energy radiated at you. So I think that's the logic of it. Whereas, which I don't think is wrong, but I mean, my approach is that the talisman is more like having the cell phone of the angel. And so that allows you to have a very quick connection to them. And then the purpose of the talisman is to help you to form that relationship. So in other words, that's what I'm typically doing with the talismans that I have as a means of contacting and forming a relationship with these angelic beings. And I'll reconsecrate it, like light the candle and do the incense or whatever. And so fumigating is traditionally you move it through the incense as a means of, it's like a friend. I mean, you want to contact them, you call up, hang out with them, and you form a relationship. So but that's only one model. I mean, there's plenty of other approaches to it, but that's the one I was drawn to. What I call that a devotional approach. It's very much like the Catholic Church with a saint or an angel. You know, it's a very similar sort of approach. And it's a personal relationship.
Well,
So,
speaking of which, could you give us a little history of talismans? Because this is very, very old.
I think that, I mean, there's a difference between, I mean, talk about talisman as a physical magical object. There's a ton of that sort of thing going on. Astrological talismans, you know, the magical practice. You know, and again, how people conceptualized what a talisman was, say for the, I mean, there's a lot of magical stuff. I mean, every society has magic, and so the talisman is basically. Here's the other thing is that the tendency is to think of a talisman as a pendant or maybe a ring, and that's a talisman.
Right.
But in the medieval Renaissance tradition, anything that is made at a particular time astrologically and consecrated can be considered to be a talisman. So for example, you think of Excalibur, you know, I was doing mirrors, you know, a magic mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all, sort of magical stuff. But you know, buildings, there's an entire city, astrological magic city described in Picatrix. You know, I've worked with artists who did, you know, paintings and things like that. I mean, there's a really wide variety of things that you can. Now you're constrained somewhat by the fact that the typical time frame for that all the factors are in place would be maybe say half an hour to an hour. So if you're going to make a talisman, it needs to be something that has a process that can be done very quickly, because otherwise stamping, casting metal, I was acid etching mirrors, You could do Sculpey. I mean, a lot of things like, but the standard engraving takes a couple hours, so that wouldn't work very well. So this is one of those things of like, in order to fit that in there. But I mean, astrological talismans, you know, there's record of astrological magic insofar as using, say, like for example, the moon phases, the waxing and waning of the moon, or the signs of the moon in the Greek magical papyri, which are like, you know, classical period. Astrological magic. The full astrological magic, full chart election, multi-factor elections, you know, basically looks like probably early medieval was when that, and that's Picatrix. The Harranian Sabians, Harran is a city in basically what had been northern Syria, or it's now in Turkey. It's in Mesopotamia. Was a real source for a lot of the philosophy and, you know, magic and science. You know, there was all mixed together, though. There wasn't a differentiation between science and magic, but astronomy, astrology, magical texts, things like that. And they may be the ones who invented it. They're the one, the first that we have a notice of it. And so that would be like 700, 800 AD. And so, and we haven't surpassed that. I mean, Picatrix is the basically the height of astrological magic in terms of that. But Picatrix was translated into Latin, like I said, in 1256, and it circulated in a manuscript in Europe. So you had to be able to read Latin in order to do it, but you'd also need a lot of math. I mean, to do the astrology, you had to do it by hand. So you had to do all the calculations. So it really took somebody who really, a lot of sort of monks and clerics had that capability. It was never that popular because the skill set was just too difficult to do. But there was significant numbers of people, and William Lilly again, who's 17th century, talks about sending a whole trunk full of talismans to Elias Ashmole, who was also an esotericist. And you know, like I said, this would be like in 1650s, things like that. So there was plenty of people making them. You know, that's, but you know, it died out because, first of all, the over. You know, come about 1700 with the quote Enlightenment. Again, the view there was that again everything was made of matter and energy, and so one of the primary focuses of the quote Enlightenment and like seeing the Royal Society and the early scientists was to stamp out what they called superstition, which is to stamp out any idea of spiritual anything basically. So, and we still have that to this day. I mean, if you know, I've seen like the National Science Foundation has a thing on astrology and it calls it a pseudoscience, and you know, and basically it's no scientific evidence. But the bottom line is that it can't work because it's spiritually based and there's no such spirituals doesn't exist. And but you know, there's what I call the truce, which is that again, about, you know, in 1700 with the Enlightenment, essentially the scientists and the, you know, the I call it is atheist materialism is what, or physicalism is this view that there's nothing except matter and energy. We're allowed to, they are the ones who define the nature of reality. But if you wanted to be religious, you could do it on Sunday and be irrational. So you could go into church and, you know, talk about God, but then when you back to work on Monday, you'd back to recognize that of course there's none of that stuff really exists. So that's kind of the state that we're in, is sort of a schizophrenia. So that if you push people, and I learned that as a child, not to ask people about religion. Because they could not explain it, and they would just get upset if you asked them questions about it. And that was one of the things that was important to me, and what I liked about traditional astrology or magic or philosophy was that there was not at that time a differentiation between science and theology. They were not in contradiction with each other. And now the reality of, I mean, people say, well, science and religion are coming together. They cannot come together. It's impossible. Because they're antithetical. Now, most people that religious, like the fundamentalism, has basically caved, and they also think that there's nothing except matter and energy in terms of their day-to-day stuff. And they have God, but then if you actually how things work, then it's, or there's miracles or something like that. I was reading a book recently about archaeology in Israel, and there's a tremendous amount of the sort of, you know, fundamentalist Christian stuff because they want to prove the Bible, which seems ridiculous to me. You know, it's like there's a ossuary, which is sort of a casket for bones, and that somebody had apparently, I mean, there's a controversy whether it's forged or not, but it said something to the effect of James, brother of Jesus, you know, so it's like this is like Jesus's tomb or something. And somehow, if you had the physical proof of Jesus, that would be the highest, again, because there's nothing more important than matter and energy. And But to me, that just seems irrelevant, you know, that the Bible clearly to me was divinely inspired. It had to be come through individual humans. So there's clearly incredibly spiritually important, but so was the sutras and the Quran and everything else, you know, and that's what's important, not the physical relic itself or the manifestation, but looking through the essence of it. And so to me, the worrying about whether Jesus, I mean, I think Jesus did exist, but that's not the point, you know. I'll give an example of that. They had the Shroud of Turin. Have you heard of that? Yeah. And so it's got this face of Jesus on it. And somebody did some scientific analysis of it, and they said, oh, it looks like it's from 1300. And I'm like, well, if it's from 1300, and it's received all this devotion over that period, and it's quote charged anyway. So, I mean, the fact that it has to be Jesus's actual thing, it's like, that doesn't particularly, you know what I mean? It's like the physical reality of it is less important than to me, the spiritual. I mean, that sort of devotion. I like that pilgrimage and all sorts of things like that. I mean, I kind of think that the Reformation was a disaster in a lot of ways. But you know, it's, you know, that's because it took me a long time, but I have more or less come to a spiritual worldview. And so to me, the world seems to be, everything is alive, you know, it's alive in its own way, but like trees obviously are alive, but I mean, they have a spirit, a rock has a spirit. You know, I had a lot of, the Zen experience I had was useful, but the Shinto, which is the sort of basic native religion of Japan, is very much has that view of the kami, everything has a spirit. And so that my wife is very much naturally in that kind of viewpoint and was very helpful, and kind of, she's, a lot of people are like that. That's their sort of natural setup and that's their natural orientation. So it's just sad that the society in the philosophy disavows that. So you can't have somebody give you a logical, rational, philosophical explanation of that. You know, they'll call it animism or something. It's just kind of putting it in a box and putting a label on it and being sort of pejorative. But there actually is, that's what one of the things I enjoy about it, is to be able to say, look, I can, if you accept the existence of the spiritual, if you're willing to open to that, then all this makes sense. And it is very logical, and I can give chapter and verse an explanation for it. You know, that's, so that's what I would say, is that the bedrock is that the magic and astrology have a spiritual basis, and then not dependent upon matter and energy, you know, and that they underlie that. And so they're really practical applications of spiritual, you know, sort of principles. And so astrology has essentially is looking at, uses geocentric, you know, we're looking from the viewpoint of being on Earth. And they all say, oh, it's fake because it's, you know, we know that the sun goes around the Earth. Well, if you look up in the sky, it does look like the sun is rising in the east and setting in the west. So it is an accurate visual explanation from the standpoint of Earth. If you go out in space, it looks differently, but we're not in space. And so if you think about, like, you know, before GPS, people were doing navigation, celestial navigation, it was geocentric and it was perfectly accurate. Same thing with surveying. If you're doing surveying, it's also going to be celestial and it's also going to be geocentric. So for that purpose, it's, you know, it's a bit like saying, well, when you see that stop sign, it's not really red because it's actually these, you know, magnetic, you know, the vision and everything and all the processes. And it's like, well, for a stop sign, it looks red. You see this red sign, you stop. So, and again, this is what I'd say about it, is it's perfectly geocentric astronomy and astrology that we use is perfectly accurate from the standpoint that we're coming from, which is on Earth. So we see these celestial cycles, which are very, very regular. You know, the planets are doing their sort of dance with each other and orbiting and retrograding and going forward and backwards. And so if you look at an astrological chart, it's a perfectly accurate 2D representation of the actual position of the planets from that time, date, and place. And if you took it to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory or the astronomers, they would grumblingly say yes. They wouldn't really deny that. So it's perfectly accurate. What they deny is there any significance to it. Because the problem with the modern worldview is that not only is it physicalist or atheistic materialist in denying there's anything except matter and energy, but they also are nihilist. So eventually it ends up being nihilistic because everything is either these random, you know, interactions of these subatomic particles or again, chance or physical laws. Therefore, there's no inherent meaning to anything. So life is meaningless and you're this, you know, tiny little person trapped in this huge universe and you didn't exist and you exist for a short time that's full of pain and then you die. And that's the ultimate view of reality. And which is perfectly accurate from the ego self standpoint. If you identify entirely with the ego self, then that's correct. So in order to find meaning, you would need to have a larger identification, you know. And and I think that that's, you know, that to me is the real tragedy of the modern era is, you know, not that people are poor, you know, that people have economic problems, but that we've somehow removed their meaning and the reason for living. And so that's one of the things that's really helpful for me because, you know, I've done over 5,000 horary charts, for example, for questions for clients, and I keep a record. I do it in writing to keep a record. And if you keep getting stuff, I don't always get it right, but if I keep getting it right again and again and again, and it's impossible because there is no spiritual reality, then you're like, that's a very tangible sort of practical recognition that in fact that this idea that there's nihilism and that nothing fits and there's random everything isn't true, that in fact the cycles of the heavens reflect the same cycles that are taking place on earth, and therefore if you see the heavenly cycles, which are very clear, we can understand the cycles on earth as well. I mean, your birth chart's the same way. I mean, it's just kind of amazing that the time, date, and place of your birth, if you look at the way the planets are arranged, you can tell a tremendous amount about someone's personality. And so that's an area of mine. When I do a natal reading for somebody, I do a modern style reading of the personality. I add some more techniques into it because traditional astrology is much more complex, has many more techniques than modern astrology. So we have some additional nuance, particularly in the negatives, because traditional astrology is predictive. So it has to have a way of mapping everything from the most positive things to neutral to the most negative. So I can look at a chart and I can do that careful calibration of the positive and negative. Whereas modern astrology, since it comes from a psychological standpoint, if you go to a psychologist, they're not going to be negative with you. They're going to want to talk to you, listen to you, be sympathetic. And even though they can only help, I mean, I'm blanking on his name, famous psychologist, he said, you know, only a third of people recover. He said a third of people aren't hurt by it. And, you know, a third of, you know, but you'd only have about a third recovery from, you know, from your typical therapy. And so, but you don't say that to your patients. You give everybody an opportunity and you want to be upbeat and positive. And that upbeat, positive nature is reflected in modern astrology, with a few exceptions. They've imported a few things like void course moon or retrograde, particularly Mercury, but all retrogrades now. And those have to take all the weight of negativity. So while in traditional astrology, void of course moon is really not that big a deal, it's a minor affliction, it's, you know, apocalyptic in modern astrology because there's just not anything else negative. So all the negativity kind of has to focus on either retrogrades or the void of course moon. The other problem with modern astrology is that, among the problems, is that for the most part, ostensibly astrology is for predictive purposes. But for mostly it's used for reassurance or for a false sense of control. And so the skeptics, you know, I certainly, you know, I don't believe that astrology works any more than I believe that atoms exist. I mean, it makes sense to me. It's not a belief system. It's that it makes sense within the thing. But my view is astrology works, but nevertheless, there's a lot of people using it not for predictive purposes. And so, again, you know, like the retrograde Mercury stuff, that's many people have heard of that, you know, and so people will say, oh, that was retrograde Mercury. Well, they can't predict it in advance what's going to happen. They don't know what's going to happen when Mercury's retrograde. And if something does happen, they can't connect it to Mercury necessarily. They can only do it after the fact. So if you can't predict it in advance and you don't understand what's going on, you know, you can look at any chart and pull anything out of it. You know, if you know what the outcome is, you can find something that will fit that outcome, but that's not prediction. So that's an unfortunate, or like I said, false sense of control. It's like, oh, if something bad happens, well, at least I know what it was Mercury retrograde. Well, not really, but you feel better, but that you at least have some idea of what's going on. So a lot of what's what people are doing, or they're looking at Hitler's chart or Einstein's chart. Oh, we can see why Normandy, whatever, because I can see Hitler's chart. Well, you already knew the outcome. So I did an example of that once. On my group, I posted this chart. It had Scorpio rising and had a lot of planets in the eighth house, which would be considered to be negative. And I said, oh, this is a famous serial killer. People said, oh, yes, yeah, famous serial killer. I said, oops, actually, it's Gandhi. And so, you know, again, depending if you know who the person's chart is, you can, again, make it fit whoever you want. And so in my natal astrology course, we don't do any celebrities and you don't do your own chart. What you get is a bunch of charts of people you don't even know. And then you have to predict based just on the chart. And so that's real astrology. That's real predictive astrology. And you know, I think that that's you know, because my focus is, you know, again, it's on actual prediction. And so again, what I'm doing is I'm going to give a written prediction in advance. And you could do it with anything. If you're a psychic, you make a written prediction in advance, and then when you get the results, you check back to see how close you're fit. Because if you're making predictions and you're not writing it down, it's very easy to fool yourself with that as well. And also, people don't want to follow up on it. So a lot of times, again, I mean, I get people asking me like a horary question, when will I get a job? And they're not asking me, they want to know, they're worried, and they want me to make them feel better. And my job, what I'm getting paid to do, is to make them feel better. So I'll say back to people, I say, well, is it going to help you if I say you're not going to get a job? And a lot of people will be upset with that, or they say, oh, well, that would make it worse. Now, some people think, no, that's useful information. I can do it. But I mean, with horary astrology, you get a lot of no's. I mean, people don't ask questions when everything's going great. They're usually asking a question when they're having problems. So it's not too surprising that things don't come back. And lots, I mean, how often do things you want to have plans they don't work out? I mean, that's frequent, like relationships. I mean, I get a lot of relationship questions. I mean, every single relationship doesn't work out, even if you'd like it to work out. So, I mean, that's, and I'm guilty of that myself. I mean, I do I Ching readings. You know, I'll do like a daily one. What's the current situation? And I certainly would like to get a positive, but you know, I accept that I don't always. And I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna roll with it. I had one today. My business has slowed down a certain amount, and I asked, and I got the hexagram four, which often the I Ching will give to you if you keep asking the same question too often. So it's like, I'm like, which I try not to do. I try to respect the oracle. And for example, I don't ask a question then ignore what it says. I don't ask the question multiple times until I get the answer I want. You know what I mean? You respect the oracle. And that's what astrology is an oracle. I mean, what's different about astrology, the predictive astrology, is that, like the traditional astrology, is that you have a tremendous amount of technique. So you can get a lot of information from the chart itself, but you still have to use intuition in your interpretation. So, for example, if someone asks me, will I marry X or have a committed relationship with X? You would look at the first house to represent the person asking the question, and look at the planet ruling that house to look at the where that person was, what state they were in. You look at the seventh house for relationships and the ruler of the seventh to look at the person you're asking about. So, for example, if the planet ruling the seventh house was afflicted, that would be an indication that the person is unable, unwilling, or unsuitable for the relationship. Now, which of those three it is, you need to look at the rest of the chart, but also use your intuition in terms of your judgment in terms of that. I've got it. Because the intuition is the ability, that patterning ability, you know, the ability to see the underlying, you know, like if you're like a paleontologist, you get the little bone, you can see the whole rest of the dinosaur. And that's something you can work at and learn. I mean, some people don't have it, other people have it naturally, but something you can definitely, you know, you work at it a lot. What's useful about the traditional astrology is you have a lot of information to start with, and you don't use your intuition to overthrow the chart. If I'm coming in with someone's afflicted seventh house, you know, afflicted planet and ruler of the seventh, I'm not going to be saying, oh, well, I'm getting this vibe that you're going to have a great relationship. You're just not going to be coming up that way in terms of the chart.
Now, in terms of charts, with regard to talismans, you highly recommend before someone purchase an astrological talisman, you need to have a look at their chart, or you should have a look at their chart, right?
I think
Because
it's useful. I think people, again, people get really, there's a lot of fear in this area. There's a tremendous amount of superstition and fear. People are scared to death. I had a guy the other day. He got Venus, a Venus talisman, and he was doing a consecration of it. And what he was doing was, rather than doing stick incense, he was doing like a resin incense. In order to do burn that, you have to get charcoal. Now, there's this sort of standard cheap charcoal that you get online or from a store that comes in a foil package and it's round, right? It is terrible because when you light it, it's hard to light it and it pops, pop, 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 and it goes out. And so he said, I got this charcoal it kept popping and it's a bad omen, isn't it? And should I stop? Should I, you know, Venus is cursing me. And I said, dude, I said, that's the way that charcoal works. I said, use Japanese charcoal. I said, that works better, you know? But that's what I'm saying. That's what people are bringing to this. And he was scared. You know, obviously the demons were coming after him or something like that. So, I mean, that's one of the things I say to people. I said, you know, really, with my talismans, you know, I don't know about anybody else's, but mine, I'm only working with angels. It's as positive, benefic magic as I can get. And really, the worst you're going to get for the most part, is nothing happens. And that's always a possibility too, because people say to me, what's going to happen? I said, it could be nothing. You know, it's, you have to take a leap in the dark with it. And if you're expecting a specific result, you know, you're, it's often going to be, you know, like particularly love tales, I want this person to come back to me. That's probably not going to happen. If you're saying I'd like love, then that's a broader thing, but you're still trying to influence the outside world to conform to your, if you're saying I would like to be transformed to be a more loving person, that's doable. You know, that's something that's, and that's pretty effective. If you become a more loving person, then you're naturally going to have, it's a much better way to have a relationship. So that's what I would say, is that a lot of it is, and but not to downplay the, because you can have miraculous effects with it, but it's unpredictable. If I could guarantee you win the lottery, I would sell it for $1 million. I mean, that's the thing about talismans. But people do have all these incredible results, but you can't expect to have, you know, again, it's not Harry Potter, it's not technology, it's not lightning bolts coming out of your fingertips, it's not 1001 Nights. It's real. And because it's real, it has to operate in the real world. So it can be instantaneously powerful, you know. And the work that you do makes a difference too. I mean, that's, there's a lot of, it's like, you know, if you heard that, oh, you know, Tiger Woods won the US Open with these golf clubs, so I want to win $1 million too. I'll just buy these golf clubs. And you don't win the Open, it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the golf clubs. I mean, Tiger Woods couldn't win the Open without golf clubs, but there's a lot more that goes into it than just buying the golf clubs. And so that's the tenet. Again, that's the technology. With an iPad, you just buy the iPad. With a, you know, a watch, you just buy it. It does it automatically for you. It's technology, but these are not technology. You know, there's
So
an interaction. There's, and so that's what I would say about it is like, I don't really, like, try to keep my prices reasonable. I'm not, if you charge $5,000, I think you're making an implicit promise about what's going to happen with the talisman. And so I
that
really try to keep the prices down. You know, that's one of the reasons I'd like to make it available to people, you know, but I also don't want to be making a, I think if it's $300 or $400, which is what I typically charge, I don't think that's as much of a promise of the miraculous effects as a $3,000 talisman.
Right, but you're following the guidelines of the Picatrix, which is a very, very important book on.
Yeah, I mean, you could do it in a different way than what I do. And even if you followed it exactly, you wouldn't necessarily guarantee, because that's what people say. They say, well, did you do all 50 things? And they say, no, oh, well, that's why it didn't work. I'm like, that's not why it didn't work. It's because no one, you couldn't follow 50 things that still wouldn't work. You know what I mean? That's not the people will do that too. They'll be like, I got this Sun Aries talisman and this happened. And I got the Sun Leo talisman and that happened. And that means now we know the difference Sun Aries and Sun Leo. I'm like, you're crazy, because it's totally subjective, it's anecdotal, you know. I mean, I had somebody, this is a long time ago, they bought a Jupiter talisman and they said, oh, 3 weeks later my mother fell down the stairs, so I threw the talisman away. I'm like, what are you talking about? Again, that's superstition. And so, I mean, I'll give you an example. Algol, very powerful protective talisman. I had this happen, and I've had, I don't know, at least 100 people report this to me, that they had electrical or electronic interference when they first got it. And that's very typical. Now, plenty of people don't, right? But someone like recently said, yeah, my whole block lost power that when it was delivered. So that it happens enough, and it's logical within that particular type of talisman, because it's a very powerful talisman, protection talisman, that yes, I think that that's, we can say that that's a typical effect, not for everybody, but typical. But oh, I did it once and this happened. How do you even know that was caused? Because other people say, oh, I got this talisman, something bad happened. I'm like, how do we know the talisman caused it, either for good or for ill? You know, that's what I would say about it, is that so much fear, you know, or credulousness, and that's one of the things I like to bring to it. But yes, I like to follow the traditional stuff, you know. As, and at the same time, what I'm doing is Picatrix. That's what people say. Well, Picatrix says this. I said Picatrix says a lot of stuff. I mean, Picatrix is a compilation. It was compiled from over 200 books, and they didn't. No one went through it and like tried to. There's a lot of contradictions. I mean, for example, there's one section that says this is just having to do with elections, of choosing when to do things like marriage or something. Don't have the moon in the ascendant, because the moon is very fast moving and it causes things not to last very long. Okay. And then I have moon talismans. And the moon talisman section says make the talisman with the moon rising. Well, of course, that makes sense, because it's the most powerful position, either rising or at the midheaven, directly over on the horizon or directly overhead. But some say, oh, you can't do those are bad talismans, because this other section of Picatrix says don't make it when the moon is ascendant. I said, well, I mean, they don't, it doesn't fit together. I mean, it's contradictory. And to look for some objective, 100% true for all time, it's just not going to make sense. I'd like to look at Picatrix in sort of modular sense. I said, if you look at the sections of it, they tend to focus on a set of, like, for example, there's a section on moon signs. So you put the moon in a sign that's appropriate for the activity. You have the moon rising or culminating, and I think waxing or waning. And those are three factors. That's about as much as you can get in an election. And that makes sense. But you don't try to put that into then the Jupiter talisman. Oh, Jupiter, what about the moon? I mean, blah. I mean, you'd have 50. If you tried to follow everything in pictures, you'd have 50 factors in an election and you could never get it to work. So Right. Just how do you sort through that stuff is what I spent a lot of. And that's the advanced part of my astrological magic course, is actually looking at these texts. And sometimes they won't have enough information. Sometimes there won't be enough in there. Other times there'll be too much. So like I said, it's a very close analogy to law, because if you're a five-year-old, it's enough to know don't follow the rules or you're going to get in trouble. And you don't go into the deeper meaning of it. You were told to do this. You do it. You follow it. And if you don't follow it, you're going to get in trouble. But that doesn't work for the person. The judge or the legislator can't have that attitude, you know, or a lawyer. Like I said, as an advanced practitioner, you cannot have that attitude about it, because otherwise, well, I mean, people do. I mean, the perfect example is this, and this is also the materialist stuff. There's a standard listing of metals that appropriate go with the planets. Now, that's only one of maybe 20 different listings. I mean, they're all over the place in terms of the traditional sources, but the standard listing of metals is Saturn for lead is lead, Jupiter is tin, Mars is iron, Sun is gold, Venus is copper, Mercury is liquid mercury, and the Mars is silver. Okay. And so people are like, why aren't you making your talismans out of lead and Saturn talismans? And I was like, well, it's not a very good material. It's poisonous. And it's also soft. Like the book says so. But the reason they really follow it, like I said, the Greater Key of Solomon, for example, has that listing in it. So people are like, why aren't your pentacles from the Greater Key of Solomon done that way? And they're like, if I try to explain everything, they're like, well, you're not following the book. You're an idiot. So they just, but they don't follow the ritual. There's this incredibly elaborate ritual and nobody worries about that. But the materials really, because the talisman is the source of the magic and matter is the source of all truth and power, comes from material objects. So he has to follow. Same thing with the whole sidereal zodiac thing. That's another one. So the zodiac that we use, zodiac is basically a 360-degree circle. It allows us to very precisely show the positioning of anything. So if you want to have an astrology, whether it's Chinese astrology or Vedic astrology or the Western and Arabic astrology that we use, they always have a zodiac, because it allows you to precisely indicate, instead of saying, you say, you know, seven Taurus, that's equivalent to saying 37 degrees of the 360-degree circle. So that's basically what it is. The tropical zodiac is oriented to the seasons. So this, on the first day of spring is when the sun enters Aries. And that's also the equinox, when the days are equal, the day and the night are equal. The sun goes into Cancer at the summer solstice, which is the time in the northern hemisphere when the sun stops moving to the north and stands still. And then it's also the longest day of the year. And then the fall, enter Libra in the fall, which is the autumnal equinox, again, the days are equal. And then you have the winter solstice, which is when the sun enters Capricorn. Very natural, very logical, makes a lot of sense. This is what everyone's been using for 2,000 years. However, it doesn't correspond to the physical constellations. And since the physical constellations have to be the source of astrology, because what else could be? Because nothing exists except matter and energy. It must be the physical stars. And doesn't correspond to the physical stars, then we just toss out the tropical zodiac. Now, sidereal zodiac is what they use in Vedic astrology. It is not corresponding to the physical stars. It has a fixed point with a fixed star fixed point as opposed to the seasons. Otherwise, it has 12 signs of 30 degrees each. It doesn't correspond. But people don't know that, but they do know that all the idiots in the past, you know, they're idiots in the past, so we're going to throw it. It's like, you know, they all thought the Earth was flat. Not true. That was invented in the 19th century to make us all feel superior. Any educated person since about 300 BC knew that the world was round. Because it's obviously round, so it's just one of those things. Like
flat today, Chris.
Well, then they again don't under not educated people. Like I said, this is sort of like that's just a modern problem, but so that's what I would say about it is that, you know, there's a lot of the sort of physicalism and everything that permeates people's thinking, yes. And that you always are going to be putting your foot wrong until you get your your philosophical and worldview in line with your practices. So if you're doing magic and yet you think the world is only matter and energy, you're going to have all sorts of these things coming up. But I get hassled all the time about the tropical zodiac. To me, it's like arguing about whether the metric system versus inches. I mean, it's a measuring system, you know, and you can do perfectly well with sidereal zodiac if you're doing Vedic astrology. But it's a lot like, you know, for example, if I'm a, you know, playing Bach and I'm trying to be in a Baroque orchestra and use a harpsichord and all that, and someone come in and said, oh, well, the ragas, they use these quarter tone scale. I'm like, that's fine. Go ahead and use it. But you're not going to be doing, you know, we don't change it around, right? And if you want to change a sidereal, you can in modern. Modern, you can mix and match. The basics, one of the things about modern astrology is you can use any technique from any type school of astrology. You just, it's because the view is it's all like Tinker Toys. You can just take it out and it works by itself and you can just stick it together with everything else and create your own thing. It's like everybody else has created their own thing, but which is fine. That's how modern works. But if you're going to do traditional, you're going to do the medieval Renaissance, we have a methodology that we use and we don't mess around with it. Like I said, ballet, why aren't you wearing, you know, tennis shoes? Why are you wearing point shoes? Because that's what we do. Well, that's wrong. We're going to throw that out. Well, you're not doing ballet anymore. It's fine to that's modern dance, you know? So that's what I would say about it is that, again, this idea of astrology, there's no astrology. There's various schools. And if someone says they do astrology, then it means they do modern astrology because that's what people have heard of. And there's, again, nothing wrong with it. I do. I like it. I think it's great for psychological stuff, but it's important to understand where you come from. And because if you don't know where you come from, you don't know your history. If you don't even know your own philosophical beliefs, you don't even know your own methodology, then you really are lost. So a lot of people are kind of wandering around in confusion and then hassling me about why I use the tropical zodiac. I'm like, whatever. There's these various different like house systems and things like that, which again, I could care less. To me, it's sort of like, you know, it's not important. You know, it's like whether you have an Intel chip or AMD chip. I don't worry about that stuff. I need to use the software. You know what I mean? Because again, that's the idea that the technique is somehow significant in and of itself and that there's a best technique for everybody. It's like there's a best paintbrush for painting. Like what? I mean, it just, you have a preference perhaps. There's techniques that maybe you can use better with your intuition, but there's no objectively better methodology. That's good. And I get that with the traditional, oh, you have to use this particular, you know, equal, whatever it is, whole sign houses or whatever. There's a huge, big fad for that and shouting. And I have people call me up on the phone and the first thing they ask me is they say, do you use whole sign houses? And I say, no. And then they just hang up. Because that's their entire decision. Because I'm not going to be working with somebody who uses whole sign out, or people say, I'm comfortable with that. That's what I like, it resonates with me. So therefore I'm going to reject everything you do based upon the fact that it's not using whole sign houses. So it's really kind of frustrating, but that comes from an attitude again, that it works itself. That's not looking at the intuition, the combination of the technique and intuition, you know, and there's, again, nothing wrong with whole sign houses if that's the choice you want to make for yourself. But it'd be nice to leave me alone and let me do my own thing without, you know, getting dumped on that. Because that's what I do as a sort of self, you know, preservation in a way, is I recognize I need to be tolerant. And it doesn't make any sense logically to me to say that I'm right because I'm right for what I do, right? I'm not a relativist though either though, because what I would say, there's no right way. There's a couple of sort of right ways and there's an infinite number of wrong ways, you know, and that's where the prediction comes in. Because take your methodology, get a question or a chart that you don't know the outcome from, make a prediction in writing, an analysis and prediction, and then check whether you got it right. And do that about 100 times, and then you can see whether or not it's workable. Yeah. You know, and that's what but again, I wouldn't try to say that only one method works, you know, because again, there's a heavy intuitional, and Vedic works, like I said, Hellenistic is a good school, you know, these are all workable schools. Modern is good too. And so you just find the one that resonates with you and the one that gives you those accurate results if you want to do predictive astrology. But very few people are doing that. Again, what most people are doing is, like I said, it's after the fact stuff, you know, or made up or whatever. So it goes.
I want to have you talk about these talismans. And so there's talismans for different planets, planetary talismans. Can you talk
about every celestial factor, like we're saying, has a soul, has a spirit. So potentially anything celestial, and well, anything, we're just happening. Astrological magic basically has decided we're going to sort of focus on astrological things, We're not doing like earth magic, you know, we're not doing magic of like stones or something. We're not doing, you know, we're not doing like Kabbalah, right? So Agrippa has three books of occult philosophy that correspond to the three worlds, the material world, the celestial world, and the divine world. And so these are all potential interfaces. So we're just focusing on celestial. So astrological magic, in my formulation, is a type of ritual and ceremonial magic in the Western tradition, because there's lots of ceremonial magic, you know, the Solomonic grimoires and things like that, that only works with astrological spirits and does so at astrologically appropriate times. So we only interact at a time that's astrologically appropriate for that celestial factor, and we're only dealing with celestial factors, and we're working in the Western esoteric tradition. But you could break that apart. I mean, there's people that do magic, they do Jupiter invocations, but they just do it whenever they feel like it. They don't time it. There's people that just time things and don't do any invocation. That was very popular in the Renaissance because they didn't want to have any be accused of working with demons. So they were like, natural magic, it works by itself, which fits with the modern view. It's rays. That's automatic too. It's impersonal. And then you can also do ritual magic and time it without working with magical, you know, with astrological spirits. Like the Goetia are not astrological spirits, but they do astrological timing for like pretty basic, like, you know, waning and waxing moon and moon sign things. So you can take it all apart, but basically that's how I, you know, how I define astrological magic. So for example, fixed stars. If you look up in the sky at night, there's stars, right? They're called fixed because their position doesn't change relative to each other rapidly like planets do. There's about 1,000 visible fixed stars, and they're arranged in 48 constellations traditionally. So 12 zodiacal constellations and then 36 extra zodiacal constellations. So potentially each one of those fixed stars you could contact as a spirit would have its own thing that it did, and you could make a talisman for it. But from our traditional sources, we have the best one for fixed stars is called Hermes on the 15 fixed stars. So we have 15 fixed stars that we have a lot of information about. So we have an image for the talisman, a picture that you could use for it. You have a sigil, like a little, like a symbol. We have things that it rules, and then we know what it does, what its functions are. So that's enough information that we can contact that spirit, and then we can make a talisman, and we pretty much know what general areas it's going to handle. But potentially it could be 1,000 of them. But you know, my view is that the original information came from direct contact with the spirits, either through dreams or visions or psychic, you know, means. So we're just going to have to wait until we catch up, you know, people starting, because I Fomalhaut, which is a star in the mouth of the Southern Fish constellation, is very prominent in my chart. It's conjunct a particular planet in my chart, and I feel like I had a close connection to it. So I did a divination about whether I could do the talisman of it, and I got a yes. So I went ahead. So the talisman I did for Fomalhaut is fish. It's easy. It's fish based. So it has a sort of fish, you know, image on the talisman, and it has a fish sigil, a sort of fishy looking sigil. And then but we have an idea of sort of what the effects are from other traditional sources, not from talismanic use, but more predictive. And so, but that seemed to resonate. But to me, the real seal of approval was the divination. I was really impelled to it, my intuition, and also that got that positive divination for it. So that's the only one I've done in, say, 25 years. But so that's what I feel like was we'll have a slow progression of modern people in this tradition that'll start doing that. Whereas I've had people say, oh, well, just willy-nilly contact them. Just like, you know, like the 17 angels of the 72 angels of the Sem, what is it, Shemhamphorish? I'll just call them all up just for do it. To me, they're less like a judge. I mean, you can talk to a judge if you have a reason for talking to the judge, but you don't just start calling them up willy-nilly. And that's what I, you know, I don't feel like the angels are just waiting around to do stuff for me, like servants or something, you know, like a customer service line. You know, I think these are super powerful beings that you want to treat respectfully. And if you have a reason for contacting them, fine. But that's the problem. Like we have a lot of fixed stars that we don't really know exactly what they do, or what the sigil or symbol are. We don't really know what to do with it. So that's the just a practical difficulty in doing that. But I think all celestial factors could, like, for example, we have names for all the, well, like the 28 mansions of the moon. That's another example. So the moon orbits the Earth in 27.5 days, and so the Vedic, they have nakshatras. Of course, someone hassled me about this, saying, well, there's 27 nakshatras and there's not, there is, there's not. They would have had some big complicated Vedic astrology thing. But anyhow, more or less, there's 27 Vedic mansions. In the Western and Arabic system, there's 28. And so the moon in each of these mansions is, they have a magical use. So they have an image again. They have the name of the lord of the mansion or lady of the mansion, and they have the use and incense and the things that it does. And so the third mansion I really love. So every month when the moon comes to the third mansion, I do an invocation of the spirit of the third mansion. There's a couple different names, and it's for all good things. So that's the magical use of it. Those are all, as far as I'm concerned, angels. But we have all that laid out in our traditional sources. It's quite easy to figure out that information. People are most comfortable with planets. And so this is, again, where it comes into this view of what we're dealing with. If you see the natal chart as sort of a map of energy, and this shows where the planets were at your birth, beaming energy at you. So, for example, Saturn was in the seventh house, but he's afflicted. Well, we maybe not even afflicted. Saturn's in the seventh house at your birth. Then, Saturn is a love talisman for me. Or if I'm having problems with relationships, it's because Saturn's fault. So I'll do remediation. I'll stop that energy or I'll fix it. And I can do that. I can easily see what's going on from looking at the chart because the planets are causing everything. They're the direct cause of all the positives and negatives. And it's all individual to me. And so if Saturn is associated, like I said, with love in my chart, if it predicts it, then Saturn is the problem or Saturn is the solution. And so that's the typical view. Again, I have a different view of it because to me, when you look at your natal chart, it's like repertory theater. You have 12 houses, so you have 12 roles, and you have 7 actors, and they can all play those roles. And so they step in and give you information. They're messengers. But my view is that the planet, like Saturn in the seventh house, is not that Saturn is messing you up or beaming energy at you, or that you can fix your chart by fixing Saturn somehow. If Saturn is predicting you have love problems, then my view would be you want to deal with it by a talisman that naturally rules love or naturally has the effect of dealing with love. So Venus. And so that would be my suggestion. Now, as you can see, that's a different approach. And it is, if you look at the talismanic stuff, there's no support in any traditional source for saying that Saturn becomes a love talisman because he's in your seventh house. If you look at Saturn, they say Saturn rules these following things. So Saturn rules old men and senators and agriculture and melancholy and occult philosophy and deeper wisdom and things like that. Or Venus is love, pleasure, playing stringed instruments, having sex, art, beauty, things like that. And so if you did a Venus talisman, then that's the kind of effects that you'd expect from a Venus talisman. Not because, Venus is in the 10th house, it'll help my career. It's like, that's different. I mean, that's not saying it's wrong, but again, the traditional, I'm trying to follow along with the, because see, what's weird about it is once you get heavily into the traditional approach, your instinctive reaction tends to follow that. And so I've had that numerous times, had a view about, this particular indication, and I'll find it in a traditional source, it follows that. Because I mean, I'm just deeply imbued with that. And I've had the same, it's a bit same thing as a lawyer with a judge. What I do is I try to predict what a judge is going to decide. And I can do that because I've spent 25 or 30 years practicing and I know how they think about stuff. And so I have the same reaction that they do, not all the time, but oftentimes. And where it'd be different from somebody who has no idea, who's not, doesn't train in law and hasn't had actual practical experience with judges. They're going to be all over the place in terms of predicting how they come out. So that's what I would say about it, is that it's a craft, and that's the same thing with this, which isn't to say, again, if you want to have that approach, that that's wrong or anything like that. It's just that, but it's not, because I don't want to be like, I'm the one who's backed up by the sources, so I'm right and you're wrong. I'm just like, what you want to do is find out what resonates for you, and then follow that approach. But it is a little problematic to have an approach where you don't understand why you've come up with things just seem automatically true to you and you have no idea why it is. And from a practical standpoint, you don't want to worry about philosophy, but it ends up being you're controlled, and I'm controlled by mine too. I'm not saying I'm independent of it, but I try to have a higher awareness of what my sources are and what my background is, but recognizing that, again, I'm not free of them. I just have weird sources.
Right.
So, but anyhow, with the talismans, if you want to make a talisman, you need to find a time that's appropriate for that particular celestial thing. So for a planetary talisman, you want to do a time when that planet's energy or whatever influence is strong. So for a planetary talisman, I look at book two, chapter 10 of Picatrix has a bunch of planetary talismans, and it lays out a bunch of factors, about three or four factors. And they kind of change around because it's a traditional source of being consistent. But if you look through that, you can see that those factors are basically that the planet be dignified in essential dignity. So essential dignity is based on the sign placement of things and where in the sign it is for the lesser dignity. So for a sun talisman, you want to have in the sign it rules, which is Leo, or in its exaltation, which is Aries. So those are the two strongest essential dignity placements for the sun. You then want to have the sun either rising on the eastern horizon, which is at the ascendant, or directly overhead at the midheaven. Those are the two strongest placements for it in terms of placement in the chart. And then you want to have the planetary hour of the planet. And the planetary hours are natural in that they start at sunrise and end at sunset for the day, and then the whole 24-hour day ends at the sunset of the next day. So you can see, though, that they're going to change. I mean, in the summertime, the summer hours are going to be long, and the winter hours, I mean, the night are going to be short. And the wintertime, the day is going to be short and the night's going to be long. So you basically need a calculator to figure it out. But each planet has a planetary, you know, during the day, maybe I think there's three. And depending on what time of year it is, it could be short or long period of time. But that's the planetary hour. You can get a calculator to do it. So you have rising or culminating, exalted or sign, planetary hour, and then you want it to be unafflicted. Now, exactly what that constitutes unafflicted is going to depend on the individual person. But for example, making and applying square or opposition, those are bad aspects. If it's retrograde, sun's not going to be retrograde, but other planets can be retrograde. That's an affliction. Combust too close to sun, that's an affliction. So there's just a whole bunch of different possibilities as far as that. Now, there's about 50 different ways to be afflicted. So if you followed every single, like Guido Bonatti lists a bunch of them in his aphorisms. If you followed every single, it's in the book, it says it's an affliction, then you're not going to be able to make the talisman. You're going to have to make a judgment about which ones you're going to follow and which ones you're going to not. So for example, I don't worry about void of course moon. Not a major affliction, so I'm not going to worry about it. You know, separating versus applying aspects. And again, in horary astrology or electional astrology, an applying aspect is effective, a separating aspect is ineffective. But that's good for malefic stuff. If you're separating from a malefic, you're separating from a square, it's not a problem. But it would be in a natal chart. So again, people know natal and they bring it into this. And so there's all that sort of stuff that goes on. Also, people are afraid. So, but you need to, what I do is I select these factors in advance. So I have these specific factors that you must have, specific factors that you can't have. Other stuff is a bonus. I don't worry. It's nice you have a bonus. I don't worry about it. And then I look ahead for elections that fit that. What I get the impression from the modern style is that you just start looking at random charts and whatever pops out at you is how you do an election. And they'll have intuitive stuff, you know. And that's, again, people will look at the chart of the talisman when I've only looked at those particular factors, and they'll start wandering all over the chart of the talisman, and they want to treat it like a natal chart. And so they're going to marry the talisman. Except the problem is the talisman doesn't have like neighbors, it doesn't have a home, it doesn't have children, it doesn't have illnesses, it doesn't have a spouse, it doesn't have secret enemies, it doesn't have a career, and it doesn't have, you know, hopes and dreams. So the chart of a talisman is not like the chart of a person. Okay, it's different, and different factors. I mean, it's universal. I mean, everything that happens at that moment, at that time, date, and place has got the same chart. Whether it's a death chart, a birth chart, a horary chart, chart of a chicken, a chart of an, you know, all the stuff is going on at the same time. You have to kind of, and each chart is going to have different things you're going to be looking at. So that's another thing to look at. But so if it's a fixed star, you want to have that fixed star rising or culminating, and the moon making and applying conjunction sextile trine, and then unafflicted. Those are the factors that I use. And that comes from our traditional sources. There's a book called, like I said, Hermes and the 15 Fixed Stars. And that's what it, again, it's got a lot of stuff in there. If you look at all, if you compare everything, that's the underlying sort of essence of it. Mansion of the moon, mansion of moon would be rising or culminating, and the moon in the proper mansion. So those are all different things that you look at. But then, so those would be the initial making of the talisman at that time.
I'm going to have you stop here, and we're going to, because we're over an hour, but we're going to go into the second hour. So come to themushroomsapprentice.com and we're going to continue, because this is absolutely fascinating. And I want you to also get into the effects of these various planets and also of house-based talismans. So we will talk about all of that in the second hour.